Later this month, an armada of 20 ships will sail to Gaza to protest Israel's violation of the civil rights of indigenous Palestinians. Violations which have included execution, plunder, and expropriation from their indigenous land. To protest such atrocities, representatives from 100 liberal groups in America, led by Helen Thomas, will also loudly manifest their same displeasure in New York during APACS, that's the American-Israel Political Affairs Committee's national conference. I think it's May 20th. Unfortunately, many anti-Zionists, in expressing righteous indignation to Israel's misbehavior in the 20th century, also condemn the so-called ethnic cleansing of the ancient wicked Canaanites by the Hebrews under Joshua. They equate very unnecessary 20th century abuses with very necessary divinely directed eradication and expulsion of some of the wickedest nations that ever existed. Such nations were determined to resist God's plan to use the Hebrews to bring the redemption to all mankind through Jesus Christ. Probably the most criticized part of the entire Bible is the Old Testament slaughter of Canaanites by invading Hebrews under Joshua. God's license to rid the land of Canaan of its wicked inhabitants also included permission to enslave them to perpetual generations. How can Christians defend such policies so contrary to modern values? In this Bible study, we'll tackle this challenging issue. Man, especially in modern times, is a particularly rights-oriented being. He tends to think of God as in the service of man, and if he is just, deferring to man's rights, man's needs, and values. So we must begin this discussion with a statement, a clear statement about God and his rights. By bringing the Hebrews into Palestine and setting up a bastion of divine ethics and religion, God was actually making possible the greatest blessing to all generations of humanity. The wicked Canaanites, densely inhabiting the land, stood squarely in his way. Should Canaanite so-called civil rights and power to corrupt the Hebrews have taken precedence over God's plan to make Canaan into a special holy land, making Christ possible? Liberals say yes. They say the universal rights of man take precedence in every age. God said no. God said that if the occupants did not surrender or flee the land, they would be killed, including women and children. So in God's agenda, not even human life comes first. We must remember that it is God that gave life as a free gift to each of us in the beginning. We don't acquire life, we receive life. And hopefully we are thankful to God for this free an undeserved gift. Strictly speaking, no one, including the Canaanites, ever has had a right to life. All of our so-called rights, even whether we live or die, belong to God. He is the life giver who can also take away life at any moment. In doing so, he is free from any moral blame. At all times, in fact, God is authorizing his death angels to take away human lives. He authorizes the deaths of tens of thousands in disasters every year. Do you think God did not foreknow and allow the Japanese earthquake that killed tens of thousands? So in a similar way, he said to Abraham 700 years before, the Hebrew entry into Canaan, that he was well aware of the mounting evil of the Canaanites. When it had reached an unendurable level in its infanticide, its homosexuality, its bestiality, he would authorize the Hebrews to become his version of the death angel, or a natural disaster, to remove such wickedness from his holy land. Let's just read a passage in Genesis. I guess I don't have it written down here. Yeah, excuse me, Genesis 15:13. Let's just read that as a kind of a foundational verse for this study. Genesis 15, chapter 13. And he said unto Abraham, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. He's talking about the Hebrew bondage as slaves in Egypt. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. And that, of course, was the Exodus. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation, they shall come hither again. Now, God is talking to Abraham when he is in Canaan. And at that time, this extreme wickedness had not risen up with the kind of pervasiveness that was going to happen 700 years later? And God is telling Abraham that his posterity, after 400 years of bondage in Egypt, is going to come back to their promised land, Canaan, which has been overrun with wickedness of the Amorites, Perizzites, Hittites, and so on. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Now, what God is saying there is the Hebrew entrance into Canaan land, modern Palestine, is going to be a very great judgment on excessive wickedness of the Canaanite, Amorite types of people that are there. It's not just a capricious desire for a living room, pushing aside lawful inhabitants and being nasty to your neighbors entering the community. No, this is a great judgment by Almighty God, authorized by Him, because His holy land is being unendurably defiled by the wicked Canaanites. Do you realize that the land of Palestine did not become holy in 1500 BC or in 1948 or any other time in history? The land of Palestine has been consecrated and holy to the Lord from the creation of the world, from the very beginning, holy as a symbol of heaven. And therefore God said about these Amorites, these wicked Amorites, He says, the land vomits them up. The land is always going to vomit up anybody who's in there illegally in wickedness. Whether it's the modern Zionists who will be vomited up today, or the ancient Amorites vomited up 1500 BC. You know, it's really interesting and ironic that the first to protest God's right to execute the Canaanites through the Hebrews are the liberals, screaming genocide and civil rights violations. But isn't it tragic that they are the very ones who, in the most callous way, in the most unfeeling disregard for the civil rights of unborn human beings, stand by and actually encourage the slaughter of hundreds of millions of unborn babies worldwide? Isn't that interesting? Talk about hypocrites. There's not a murmur about the civil rights of these precious little children, so vulnerable, and yet enshrined with the greatest rights of could possibly be given to humanity, to the unprotected unborn. Now, abortion kills millions for absolutely no moral ends, except the convenience of fornicating people. Isn't that basically what it boils down to? God, however, authorized the killing of the Canaanites, the ridding of the land of the Canaanites, for a noble, high-minded moral objective, which is making at least one place on a corrupt, blood-soaked earth, which could be a bastion of holiness and sanity, where Jesus could touch down. And so it's very simple. If the Canaanites were allowed to remain, there would exist no holy land, no holy people, no holy God Jesus coming to earth to redeem the world. God, who gave the Canaanites life, thus, for his own long-range benevolent purposes, took it away, young and old. The wicked among them, the truly wicked, have hell to pay. You know, Paul says that they who having not the truth are nevertheless, the conscience is a light unto them, either accusing them or excusing them. And this was true of the ancient Canaanites. God doesn't judge everybody equally. The very wicked among them, hardened in their sins and perversion, still have hell to pay. But for the innocent and those doing the best they could, including young children who were killed by the sword of the Hebrews, God is merciful, isn't he? And they actually, I'm not rationalizing that they are actually so much better off than if they had been allowed to stay in that extremely corruptive environment and lose their souls and become wicked and kill their babies and all this kind of things, become homosexuals and into bestiality, all these wicked perversions.
Well, there were members of those races like Ruth and Rahab. Yeah, right, Rahab, who were allowed because they turned their hearts.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't, okay, you're Canaanite, you have to die. It was, you are making a moral choice against God. You are corrupting the land. It wasn't about race. It was about the moral choices of people that were corrupting this place that God had made.
Yeah, she just took the words right out of my mouth. All right. What were the sins of the Canaanites? We're not going to go into this in detail. This, of course, is a whole subject of history. But in brief, the Canaanite deities, their pantheon of gods, engaged in all kinds of sexual deviant practices, including incest and bestiality. And this was transferred down to the priests and the people.
Obviously, they said that they did. They didn't actually.
Yes, sure. The gods don't exist. They were a projection. Yeah, they were a projection of this humanistic religion, giving endorsement to the vilest perversions, and worship required male and female prostitution in these cults. Baal worship, Chemosh, Ashtaroth, and on. There was a whole pantheon of the Phoenician gods, even. Carthage, Phoenicia brought in a lot of this, even in the years, the centuries subsequent to Abraham, and it was actually required that you be involved in male and female cultic prostitution in the temples of these wicked deities. And one of the very worst, of course, was infant sacrifices. And Catherine Kenyon, when she and others excavated Jericho around the turn of the century, found hundreds of jars, ceramic jars with the bones of little babies inside of the jars, which were offered to the gods. And of course, Ishtar, we mentioned in our Bible study on Esther that Ishtar, after whom she is named, actually required that the firstborn children be offered as a necessary part of the cult of Ishtar and Marduk worship in Babylonia. Let's just read the definitive command by God to extirpate this wickedness. That's Deuteronomy 20, 16 through 18. You know, it's kind of common to say, well, we, especially in regard to homosexuals, we love the sinner, but we hate the sin. But that's a little bit kind of hair-splitting, because the sinner and the sin are usually pretty much inextricably bound together, aren't they? And it's kind of tempting to say, well, the offensives of the Hebrews against the Canaanites were not against the people of Canaan, they were against the religion of Canaan. But it was clear that the religion of Canaan had gotten into the very corpuscles of the people. And that's another indication why even the young, even the women and children, had to be removed from possible contamination of the Hebrews.
I think that I read somewhere on a pro-homosexual blog or something that there was a homosexual who was talking about love the sinner, hate the sin, and he was actually really offended by that because he says, you know, homosexuality is my identity, it's my sexual orientation.
Right.
And so they call it sin, obviously, but mm-hmm. to them it's like, that's our identity, you know, that's so rude and offensive to them. So
well, it's been very popular in recent decades to promote a doctrine of love as covering all sin, and we can make this dichotomy so we don't have to personally rebuke and personally confront mm-hmm. and specifically describe the sins of people. But through the abstraction of love, we can fulfill our moral duty to let them know of salvation and so on without the necessity of biting down in specific denunciations of their personal sins. And we can also do the work of God without anger, without righteous indignation against sin. And yet, out of the Old Testament, one of the values of the Old Testament is we see this righteous anger, the sword of the Lord, actually going out in vivid, literal, specific instrumentality against the forces of evil. And while Christ said, don't take up the sword lest you die by the sword, nevertheless, the Old Testament says, cursed is the one who does not lift his sword against evil. And certainly Phinehas did this. He took a javelin and drove it through the Canaanite woman who was in the tent with a Hebrew young man. And these vivid examples, this militancy of God and the Hebrews and his champions against wickedness, even to the point of killing them, is something Christians don't have today, and yet we should have that. Because in order to be a soldier and go out and effectively war against sin, we have to have a conception of what a real soldier is. Christ did not say Scripture does not say that we are the psychologists of the world, or the social workers of the world, or even the civil rights activists of the world. We are soldiers armed for battle, with a clear intent of victory over our enemies to the greatest extent we can possibly make happen in this world. And that's what we see patterned in an archetypal way throughout the Old Testament. It says in Deuteronomy 20:16, but of the cities of these people which the Lord thy God doth give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth. But thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee, that they teach you not to do after all their abominations which they have done unto their gods. So should ye sin against the Lord your God. Now, this is a scorched earth policy. This is a non-compromise. There's hardly any way we can rationalize that this was, kind of a no-win war type of thing. We got involved in Korea. We got in Vietnam. We got in the Middle East in no-win wars, where we never attempted to conquer. We attempted to go in as a police action and just kind of bring things under control. You know, bring freedom to Iraq and Afghanistan, and everybody knows how well that's worked. If you're not decisive in battle, you're not going to have decisive victories. And that's not what God is describing in here. He's talking about a literally scorched earth policy of ridding the land, sweeping the land free of any possibility of Canaanite influence corrupting his chosen people and sabotaging his great plan of the ages. Let's just read a little more of this. I have a mild digression here. When thou shalt besiege a city a long time in making war against it to take it, thou shalt not destroy the trees thereof by forcing an axe against them, for thou mayest eat of them, and thou shalt not cut them down, for the tree of the field is man's life to employ them in the siege. Only the trees which thou knowest that they be not trees for meat, thou shalt destroy and cut them down, and thou shalt build bulwarks against the city that maketh war with thee until it be subdued. You know what the settlers, the ultra-Orthodox settlers, are doing now in the West Bank? They're going down in gangs armed with their machine guns and assault rifles, and they are cutting down hundreds, if not thousands, of Palestinian olive orchards, olive trees that have, some of these are 500 years old or older, very ancient olive trees which have been the life of the Palestinian economy for millennia. And in flat-out contradiction of the Old Testament Mosaic law, they're going down and they are cutting down these olive trees. In fact, I wrote an article about a month ago about a band of about 20 settlers who came down fully armed, proceeded to cut down the trees of Palestinians. Palestinians came out. They are not allowed to carry weapons. Oh, no. Strict gun control on Palestinians. They came out with knives, butcher knives, kitchen knives, and rocks, and started throwing rocks at these settlers, ultra-Orthodox settlers, bristling with armaments. And there was an altercation, and I believe it was 9 of them were sent to the hospital there in Hebron. And 8 of them were seriously wounded with bullet wounds. And, of course, the settlers, this is our right, this is our land. We have the right to cut down the olive trees. Do you see how the Talmudic rabbinic law has overthrown even the simplest scruples of the Old Testament? Also, compare here. You know, when these great despots of the ancient world, like Sargon and Nabopolassar and Shalmaneser, all Assurbanipal, these Assyrian and these Babylonian warlords, they come through the land, and they would literally carve in stone the records of their atrocities against the people that they had conquered. They would describe how they'd cut off their noses, cut out their tongues, gouged out their eyes, led them across the burning sands with hooks in their jaws to distant exile. They wanted the world to know that if anybody failed in their efforts to resist their conquest, it was going to be absolutely incredibly nightmarish life that they were facing, certainly in slavery. And here we have, right after God commands the Hebrews to do the necessary work of cleansing the land, here we have tremendous empathy and compassion for all things olive trees, fruit trees. God is saying, I want to get rid of all these baby killers and these perverts and these people who have sex with animals. But I care about the trees because I made the trees, and every year they produce olives, they produce apricots, they produce peaches and all these wonderful things for the benefit of the man. Don't get so carried away, he says, with your war that you start desecrating and burning the land in a wanton way so that the world becomes a wasteland, you see. So what you see in the Old Testament, which is misrepresented and covered up by the liberals, you always see this eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, hard line that God takes against wickedness, but you always see this humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Always this humanity throughout the Old Testament. God even says if you're out in the field and you, and a quail flies up and there's 12 eggs there, he says, don't take them all. Don't take all the quail eggs. Don't take all the partridge eggs or whatever the bird is, because that's really discouraging to her. Have all of her eggs taken away. Take a few for your own sustenance, for the needs of your life. But don't frustrate her in her purpose. Now, isn't that something? You don't find that kind of compassion in the laws of Hammurabi or the ancient laws of Egypt or Mesopotamia or whatever. So there's this wonderful ambience and grace that goes all throughout the rigors and sometimes the harshness of the Old Testament, which to me suggests higher origins than just human legislators. We have some important points to remember. Let's just have a couple more of these definitive passages before we go on. Turn to Deuteronomy 7, 3 through 5. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son, for they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy thee suddenly. But thus shall ye deal with them. Ye shall destroy their altars and break down their images and cut down their groves and burn their graven images with fire. For thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love upon you nor choose you because you were more in number than any other people, for ye were the fewest of all people, but because the Lord loved you and because he would keep his oath which he has sworn unto your fathers, hath the Lord brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you out of the house of bondmen from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And so on. Wonderful, wonderful passages. I wish I could keep reading. And of course, along with this comes this land covenant which God makes unto the Hebrews for all time, including our age today, that if they will obey the Lord, hearken unto him, and exercise justice and righteousness and mercy, he will allow them as a nation to enter and occupy that land, and also he will honor the covenant he made with Abraham. But if they disobey him, he will not honor that covenant with the wicked, and he will not allow them to come in and occupy the land, but he will cause them eventually to be exiled. Let's look in verse 12 briefly. Wherefore it shall come to pass, if ye hearken to these judgments and keep and do them, that the Lord thy God shall keep unto thee the covenant and the mercy which he swear unto thy fathers. Now that's a definitive verse where God says that the validity, the perpetuity, the enforceability of God's covenant with Abraham is conditional upon Jewish obedience to God. I'll just read it again. Wherefore, if ye hearken to these judgments and keep and do them, the Lord shall keep unto thee the covenant and the mercy which he swear unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Conveniently, this verse is swept under the rug by evangelicals who want us to believe that there's an unconditional covenant made with Abraham that is unalterable over time, has nothing to do with obedience or disobedience on the part of the Jews. And then let's turn over to Deuteronomy 12, 2 and 3. Ye shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which ye shall possess serve their gods, upon the high mountains and upon the hills and under every green tree. And ye shall overthrow their altars and break their pillars and burn their groves with fire, and ye shall hew down the graven images of their gods and destroy the names of them out of that place. I was doing a little research on this subject on the internet, and one commentator was saying that there's a certain rhetoric and hyperbole in the ancient world among the conquerors of ancient empires in which they felt free to talk about mass annihilation and extermination and conquest and using rhetoric like this. And nobody really believed it. And he said that the Hebrews had borrowed this kind of exaggerative language. And when the Hebrews under Joshua and so on boast of driving out the Canaanites and annihilating them and so on, it was saying we can take that with a grain of salt. It really didn't happen. It really wasn't as violent and bloody as the Old Testament makes out. I believe it was. I believe God commanded literal annihilation, and when the Old Testament says so, it really happened. And again, it's good that children read these stories and read these passages even from their infancy. It is necessary that our young people today have a Spartan background in the Old Testament deep in their subconscious, so that they will view themselves as fighters and defenders of Christianity, even to the point of going out and protesting and speaking out and taking action and reproving in public and taking a stand for Christ. This comes out of teaching and a background in the Old Testament. And it never did young people any harm to get the kind of biblical balance and perspective from the Old Testament concerning evil, wickedness that we're talking about today. If we don't give them this background, and if all they hear is the Golden Rule and Sermon on the Mount and those safe passages of the New Testament, which have proven themselves not to inspire too much controversy, then we have children without salt in their vein, without fight, without vision. And of course, without vision, the people are going to perish. Christianity will perish. Let's just consider a few points that are important to remember in all of this. We have to realize that Canaan had become very densely populated in the 700 years since Abraham was there. One of the tenets of evolution is that man has been occupying these countries for not just tens of thousands, but hundreds of thousands of years, ever since certainly the Ice Age. Mesopotamia has been inhabited and so on. But what we see in the book of Genesis is that when Abraham arrives with Lot, the land is before them. It's this huge, fertile, waving grass plain, and one man can say, okay, I'll take this huge chunk. You go down to the well-watered plain of Sodom. There's just land to be given away here, prime pasture land, forest land, agricultural land. Nobody around to compete with us or say you can't have that property. And it's at that time that God says to Abraham, I'm going to give this all to you. From the Red Sea, clear up to the Sea of the Philistines, which is the Mediterranean Sea, clear over to the Euphrates River. I'm going to give it all to you, as long as you and your posterity trust in me. But the evidence is that by the time the Hebrews came in, and the 12 spies went in, the land was densely populated. Giants filled the land. There were many cities there. There were lots of people. And so when the Hebrews penetrated that land in a very militant way, in a way guaranteed to inspire terror, I mean, what's a superstitious Canaanite going to think when this horde of 1.5 million people come out of the desert, where there's no food, the desert of Sinai, and here they come in and they walk around blasting trumpets around the city and the walls of the city fall down. I mean, that's as much as to say that the gods of these new people are stronger than the gods of Canaan. And so it is not surprising that the whole Mideast of that day, near Mideast, was in a state of high alert, high aggressiveness, high mobility, and unity such as they had never had in their existence. And that's we see accounts of the nations, literally, what were they, five kings that the Hebrews put their feet upon? Five nations, five huge armies gathered around this tiny, relatively tiny, invasive tribe that had come in. And so there was a culture of war which surrounded the Hebrews at almost every time in their existence. And we are safe in our beds. We come home, we relax, we have dinner, we watch TV, we get up in the morning, and we don't really have to worry about predacious enemies swooping down upon us in the middle of the night, do we? Devastating our gardens, cutting down our trees, burning down our houses, raping our wives and our maidens, and hauling us off into slavery. We don't have to worry about that at any time. But for the great majority of the time, Israel was encapsulated inside of extremely aggressive and volatile borders of enemies, a succession of enemies that were intent on destroying Israel. Now, one of the terms God laid down in the Mosaic Law was, I have told you, what we enumerate them right here, Hittites, the Perizzites, the various Amorite nations. He said, I want you to do this to these nations, but I'm not authorizing you to go beyond that. I'm not authorizing you to go into offensive wars to the Hittites to the north and to the east and so on. And as such, God said, I'm going to give you dominion over all these people in the allotted area that I have assigned to you. If you obey me, I'm going to do it little by little, but I'm going to give you dominion, but I don't want you to go out launching aggressive expeditionary military adventures outside of Canaan land. What I'm saying here is that the offensive, the need for war, the need to respond was coming from the invasions of these nations surrounding Israel at almost every time in their history, necessitating a warring culture, a warring mentality, a kind of a hard-bitten and even recriminatory realism in dealing with these killer bees, literally killer bees, trying to constantly come in, destroy the Hebrews, exile them, and so on. And that's why we in our proverbial armchairs, wishing that they were being more moderate or more tolerant or more indulgent or whatever, are not really living in the real world of military reality of 1500, 1000 BC. And I mentioned earlier that Israel's punishment. Sometimes there are evidences in the Old Testament that I think it was that David put, forget exactly who, was it Ammon? He put them under saws and made slaves out of some of these peoples to a certain degree. But the record was that there was a chronic antagonism going on, often for centuries, with these nations who were perpetually trying to invade the land of Israel. A tremendous thorn in the side of the people of Israel, and certain necessary measures of recrimination, punishment, even retribution may well have been in order. Another fact we have to remember is that a number of Israel's battles were entirely defensive. In fact, a very great deal of them. Israel, the Hebrews, entered in an offensive way, but and certainly the record is of a great deal of conquest. But the Hebrews did not obey the Lord with the kind of fidelity that He required. And so these nations did remain as thorns in their side, and a number of Israel's battles, violent bloodlettings and so on, were entirely defensive in nature. Another thing that's important to realize is that Israel's offensive was not racist in any way, was it? It was to eliminate the religious infection, the disease of idolatry that inhabited like a sea surrounding them. It was in fact to drive out these Canaanites and their religious practices. It was not to annihilate these people for purposes of genocide or as an end to itself, but it was to dispossess them, drive them out, remove them from possibility of corrupting God's experiment. Let's just read a little bit about this. Exodus 23, verse 27. And God is very closely with them in this whole dispossession of their enemies. I will send my fear before thee, and will destroy all the people to whom thou shalt come. And I will make all thine enemies turn their backs unto thee. And I will send hornets before thee, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before thee. I will not drive them out from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field multiply against thee. But little and little I will drive them out from before thee until thou be increased and inherit the land. And I will set thy bounds from the Red Sea even unto the Sea of the Philistines, and from the desert unto the river. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and thou shalt drive them out before thee. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in thy land, lest they make thee sin against thee, against me. For if thou serve their gods, it will surely be a snare unto thee. Let's just talk briefly about the issue of killing of children and of slavery. I mentioned this earlier, but there are certain issues of logistics and practicality that rule military activities in all ages, in fact. But back in that day, when you have a highly mobile army coming into the land, you are surrounded by enemies. It, in addition to just fulfilling God's command, it was, in my opinion, virtually impossible that the Hebrews be allowed to kill combatant males, adult males, and yet take in the women and children, especially the children, and absorb them into Hebrew life as a part of a humanitarian concession and so on. I think that even teenagers, I know when I was 8 years old, I was a firebrand after I got saved when I was 8 years old. I went out and I got my little friend converted out in his father's wood shop. I got him down on his knees, got him thoroughly saved. His name was Mike Parlett. I wonder where he is today. Anyway, the next day the devil got into this little kid, and he came out and started raving at me and cursing me, and I think it was a demonic attack on that little boy. And I went weeping up the hill, failing in my first evangelistic mission. But what that shows is that children, even an 8-year-old child, can become a real ambassador for the religious dogma that he has inherited from his parents. Mm-hmm. And even younger, perhaps. And God says, I cannot burden the Hebrews with this humanitarian social services mission of killing their parents and then bringing in the children and raising the children and re-educating them and converting them over to the truth. He says, children that young who have not sinned with any kind of real malice and hatred against God or hatred against mankind, I'll take care of them. I'll take them all to heaven. I'll take them all to heaven, and they'll be infinitely better off than they would be if they'd been allowed to live and become temple prostitutes and killing their own children. Isn't that fair? I don't think that's a rationalization. And so, similarly, in wartime, a platoon, a regiment that is surrounded by the enemy, is in great peril for its own existence, cannot always handle the prisoners that it takes. And of course, this is shocking, but sometimes it is necessary in military ethics in order that the Allies survive to take no prisoners. That's a euphemism for just going ahead and shooting the prisoners in order to not be fettered and dragged back by prisoners who are improperly contained, who are going to turn upon your forces and actually kill you and join with their enemies and so on. And I'm glad we don't have to get into military ethics today, but it is necessary sometimes to not take prisoners, keep mobile, keep on the offensive, especially in extremely dangerous circumstances.
Well, and also in the environment that you've described, it certainly wouldn't be safe to leave defenseless women and children at the mercy of the neighboring tribes that were so warlike, and so that would not have been a mercy to leave them defenseless alive.
There's just too many complications in mixing humanitarianism with war. This was war. This is the purpose of war, is to achieve military objectives as humanely as you can, but the objectives have to be met. And let the historians write their criticisms, but if you're out there in battle and the outcome of the conflict is extremely uncertain, sometimes things are done which cause us to blush in our ethical standards, but which certainly are necessary. Now, another thing having to do with prisoners, in all of these ancient empires, especially Rome, there were the taking of literally countless prisoners. Rome conquered everywhere from Spain to Britain, Gaul, clear over practically throughout Germany, as well as all throughout the Middle East. And in the process of those conquests, they considered it humanitarian to make slaves of enemies in battles rather than killing them on the spot. And often these slaves came back to Rome and may have been manacled, but on the other hand, some actually obtained their freedom and were able to enter into Roman life to a very great deal. And so slavery was an institution in the ancient world. And this was true of the Hebrews. As they were in wars of conquest, they had the opportunity to just kill the Canaanites on the spot or to give them life as slaves. And the Old Testament is very specific. I don't have the verse here, but it's very specific that the Hebrews were entitled to do the merciful thing and make a slave out of a Canaanite rather than killing him. And the Old Testament says that once he is a slave, he is not to be repatriated back. And if he breeds any children in slavery, that child is to remain in servitude with his parents as part of a servant class in Israel. And of course, how do you keep slaves from running back over the Ammonites or the Moabite territory? Well, there's such a thing as chains, and it's not a pretty picture. But there would be, if I were apprehended in battle in these times, and my captor said, would you rather be a slave or would you rather us kill you right now? I'm sure just about every captive would say, I'd rather be a slave. At least there's a glimmer of hope. At least there is life and whatever. Now, that option is sweetened by the fact that the Hebrews had a reputation for being merciful. Remember that? Who was it? Agag said, we know that the Hebrews are merciful. Let's have this charade and so on. Let's go before the Hebrew king and say, surely the bitterness of death is past and maybe he'll have mercy. And so the Hebrews had a reputation gotten from the Mosaic Law of mercy, not being in the same category as the Assyrian, Babylonian monarchs who gloried in their complete lack of mercy. And so what we see is a provision for slavery in the context of the ancient world that eventually may have had a benevolent effect when we consider that kindness was encouraged as a part of the Mosaic Law. In fact, the slave masters in ancient Israel were commanded by God very specifically to treat kindly the stranger in the land. And the stranger in the land certainly would be the slaves involved in involuntary servitude. And so there's a possibility, if we read between the lines, that if you had a benevolent slave master who acquired a number of Philistine slaves, whatever, that as God commanded the Hebrews to be kind to their animals, the just man, it says in the Old Testament, regardeth the life of his beast. So we can expect that same humanity, that same spirituality, would have been transferred even to slaves. Now, some will say, well, why didn't God just let them repatriate these slaves, send them back, and let them go back to the lands of their origin? Well, again, going back to the lands of their origin would have meant that they may well have been so embittered that they would give intelligence information, they would be actually enlist again to fight against the Hebrews and so on. And precarious as the situation was back then, there is a point to be made of keeping slaves, keeping captives in the land and not letting them go back and become a positive force of opposition to the Hebrew nation. Now, a lot more could be said about this, and this, of course, is a large study in itself, but can't we say in conclusion that the overall fruit, the overall verdict of history must be that God was vindicated in cleaning out all of these people in order that Jesus Christ come to the world? The wickedness of the ancient Phoenicians, Babylonians, Canaanites, Amorites, and whatever stands on a par with the blood sacrifices we find in the New World with the ancient Aztecs, Mayas, Incas, and so on, in which they were cultures of death, cultures of perversion. I don't think they had so much perversion in the New World, but they had this culture which was dependent upon blood in order to keep the seasons going, the sun's rising, the rain's coming down, and so on. These cultures on both sides of the Atlantic were particularly evil, particularly demonically infested, and God, in His wisdom and even in His charity and in His love, lays down hard-line, scorched-earth policies in the Old Testament which cause the liberals to have consternation, even caused some of those on the far political right to criticize the twisted Jewish ethics of the Old Testament. In fact, I did write an email just last week about David Duke's denunciation of these various things, of killing the Canaanites and allowing slavery. And he and others, including others, evolutionary right-wingers, believe that this is a result of the misevolved, twisted ethics of a twisted race, the Jews, which are manipulators and schemers and bloody and hypocritical from the very beginning. And that's not so. The evidences of history, the fruits of history, in my opinion, overwhelmingly prove the necessity in this transition period in the relations of God and man that these wicked people be removed from the land as much as possible, so that hundreds of years, even thousands of years later, at Bethlehem, there was relative calm, relative law and order, after the Romans had come in and the Greeks had come in and established laws and roads and institutions of society to keep the public order. No longer were that wicked Amorites and the Baal worshippers and the human sacrificers in command, but it was possible for Jesus to come down and take advantage even of the great wealth of learning and rationalism and thought that the Greeks brought, and the laws that the Romans brought, and the order that these civilizations brought. It was possible for Jesus Christ to come down and in a relatively calm and rational environment begin to enunciate his great principles of salvation for all mankind. Yes, barbarism was still around, and the crucifixion was one of the most barbaric rites of execution that can possibly be imagined. And the Roman Empire's tendency toward violence was revealed in Pontius Pilate's willingness to placate the crowd, even to the point of death of Jesus. Nevertheless, none of this would have been possible if the Canaanites had still been there. The whole truth of the gospel would have been eradicated, blended into the racial mixture of the ancient Middle East 1,500 years ago, 1,500 years before Christ, if God had not laid down these very vivid, hardline, and even shocking requirements for the Jewish people. Amen?
Amen.
Amen. Any thoughts on this?
Why couldn't they have just gone somewhere else? That's what the unbelievers kind of want to know. I mean, why? You're saying that they had to kill all these people for Jesus to come, but Jesus could have been born somewhere else.
Where's else?
There are other people like that everywhere.
Was the world really populated at that time?
Oh, yes, very much so.
Just because we don't know about it at
that point.
Okay, where could the Hebrews. Let's do a little geography here. You want to take the Hebrews to Africa and go back, make an exodus down to the southwest into darkest Africa with tsetse flies and malaria and all kinds of hard pan soil and tropical violence down there with black savages. Is that where you want to take them? How about off to the east toward Saudi Arabia, and even as far over as India to the east, with the tremendous confusion already at that time, confusion of pantheistic religion in East, with the beginnings of Hinduism, and even further to the east of Buddhism and so on. The apostles were forbidden to go to the east. How about up into the Aegean and Mediterranean area, which were already densely inhabited by not only the Etruscans, maybe even as early as 2,500 years B.C., or the Greeks in 1,000 time in Homer time, warring Greeks, fighting all the time. So there wasn't any other place. Mm-hmm. And besides that, you can't even begin to address this question without great respect for God's rights, God's sovereignty, God's program, God's long-term benevolent agenda. If we descend into a social consideration of the needs of all of the different parties involved,
right,
which is what the liberals want to do, what the evolutionists want to do, because they discount this long-term agenda, then yeah, sure, there's civil rights violations all over the place, and ADL should have been invented 2,500 years ago to take care of all of these nuances of civil rights, but no, there was no place to go. Yeah.
Well, that's why what you're saying is that we have to look at God's rights. And personally, I feel like the strongest defense of this situation is not pragmatic or anthropological.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about that they had to live there, or, you know, you've given us a lot of good pragmatic reasons,
mm-hmm.
but I just think the liberals aren't thinking big enough here. I mean, if we're going to be mad at God that he allowed and authorized the Hebrews to kill the Canaanites, then we really, really, really need to be mad at him for the flood. But they don't bring that up. I mean, the flood is basically God killing way more people than died in Canaan in a mass execution that he had every right to perform, because human life, as you said, is alone.
Mm-hmm.
It's God permitting us to exist on earth temporarily to make a decision about our eternal destiny, and God has the right to pull that plug anytime he wants.
Yes.
And I just think that one thing that we always have to remember in this conversation is that God has a completely different value system regarding death than human beings do.
Yes.
I mean, to humans and liberals, this life is the point. This is home. This is where we need quality of life, and we need to have our rights. But to God, this is basically a hallway. We're in a hallway, and we get to pick which door we want to go into to spend our life.
Yes.
We're not in the home. We're in the hallway with the mud and the boots and the, you know, just a waiting room, basically,
mm-hmm.
to make a moral decision for our eternal soul. And really, when you go through that door is not the biggest consideration with an eternal perspective. You know, if you're looking at eternity,
mm-hmm.
really, oh, you died at 33 instead of 75? Well, we all die. So it's just, we always have to remember that extremely different vertical perspective that we have. We're never going to meet. There's never going to be a meeting of the minds between a person who believes that this life is essentially just a blip and a waiting room versus somebody who believes that this life is the sum total of the human existence, where we need to have our rights validated and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just think that the flood and God's right to basically say, I don't want these people to keep living. I don't want this culture to continue. And that's my right, is to say this culture is so offensive to me at this point that I don't want it to continue to exist in front of me, to have to keep watching babies be ritually killed.
Yes.
And say that that's for the deity, say that that's for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to watch women be forced into prostitution. I don't want to see this anymore,
mm-hmm.
so I'm going to wipe them out. I have the right to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Just like he had the right to perform the flood.
Yes.
Ultimately, it's not about the Jewish people. It's about God and what this tells us about his character and his perspective on the value of this very temporary passage through human life.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's
very good. Well, the I'll get you in just a second, Aaron.
No, I actually answered my question.
Okay.
Yeah,
the truth is, God has all the rights. We have none.
Right.
And the liberal thinks that there's such a thing as the universal and inalienable rights of man. And it's true. There, God has sanctioned rights of man against other people.
Against other people.
You see, a right means that you have some kind of protection against somebody who wants to do harm to you.
Yeah.
Now, God doesn't want to do harm to anybody. When you have a benevolent being who's transcendently holy, and not only that he is love, you don't need rights against him. You don't need a piece of paper. You don't need laws. You don't need legal protections against that kind of benevolence who's seeking your good entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And what this reveals from the Old Testament is that there are times in history when the benevolent purposes of God must be expressed. They must be unfettered. They must go forward in a kind of tough love necessary to facilitate and further that love. And as I was saying, I feel that that's been majestically vindicated. And any liberal or any white supremacist or whoever who wants to bring out a humanistic requirement saying if God were just and if the Mosaic Law were inspired, somehow they would have parleyed with these people, they would have assimilated them, they would have formed discussion groups with them, they would have lived with them, they would have argued with them. That's just not the real world of 1500 BC. And God had to have a holy people. He had to have a holy land in order to bring the Son of God into the world without misfiring in any way. And there have been people, even among the Hebrews, hordes of them, in fact, who have joined with the spirit of the Canaanites in trying to sabotage God's great plan of the ages. Esau was one of those who would have let it slip by, and many, many others would have made their peace with the flesh and with compromise and so on in order to please man and have peace in their time. But in that day and in our day, what we are working to create are young people, are fighters who have the same spirit of Phinehas, of Joshua, of Moses, who say, okay, we're in a fight. Evil is going to triumph. God is going to be frustrated and his purposes defeated unless we go out and we fight and we get down and dirty against liberalism, against Zionism, against pornography, against homosexuality. I'm not talking about in the flesh, but we are get down and we are willing to protest and willing to go out and involve ourselves in the political process, in the social in demonstrations as you young people did several weeks ago, and be criticized by the local rags and be mocked and become a spectacle. It all goes back to the Old Testament. It all goes back to avoiding the smooth things and doing those things which may be hard as the Lord commands us. Yes?
I'm probably not thinking properly about it, but I don't really understand what you're saying about the Holy Land so Christ could come.
Yeah,
it certainly wasn't holy. It wasn't like he created a culture of holiness and reverence toward God that was
in comparison to the Canaanites.
In comparison to the
Well,
Canaanites,
yes.
But when Jesus came, the Romans were in charge.
Well, the Romans were charged, but there was a culture there.
Yeah.
There was a culture there.
But there was a population of Jews there were temples, there were people who had holy hearts, and it was a minority, but they were still there.
Framework that was waiting for the Messiah and
was
going to be able to announce him to the world,
right,
and send out missionaries.
And that's exactly what the whole purpose of this was to create a remnant of faith who would always be standing before the Lord in every age. It may have been only 7,000 in the time of Elijah, but there had to be this elect waiting and yearning for the advent of the Messiah, however that Messiah would manifest himself. And we don't owe anything to the Jewish people, but we owe a very great deal to the faithful tiny minority in Israel in every age. And fortunately, there was always a person there. There was always one person that we know of, at least in the time of the latter minor prophets, before the intertestamental period. There was always a remnant there of faith who justified what God had done in Canaan land in bringing them out. And that point of contact on earth was necessary when Christ was beamed down. It was necessary that there be faithful people there waiting for him, like the aged people in the temple, waiting for the consolation of Israel as the best they could understand it. Any more?
Well, yes. Someone that's going to write off the Old Testament and what happened to the Canaanites, it seems like their vision of God wouldn't have any way to explain what happened in Japan. The fact that God just allowed way more people to die than ever died at the Hebrew sword.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we need to have a big enough perspective of what it means that there is a divine superintelligence who has prepared an unending existence for us after our hearts stop beating and our lungs stop breathing, mm-hmm. and that his justice and his perfect mind will assign us where we spend eternity. I mean, that is such a bigger picture of life than we would have if we look at these things on a merely physical level. And I just read a quote from a modern Christian, a Vietnamese pastor who's in prison right now for being a Christian, and he said, over here we have learned that suffering is not the worst thing.
Mm-hmm.
Disobedience to God is the worst thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's what the Old Testament exists to teach us, mm-hmm. is that God does have rights to execute any of us. And we don't just learn from the Old Testament to have a battle mentality against the world. We learn to have a battle mentality against our own sin because life is that passing and that finite, and God could take it from any one of us at any time,
yes.
and be perfectly justified in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have, people have such a problem with the Jews for exterminating the Canaanites, but there seems to be no understanding of the fact that God just made them his agents to judge them in a way that he's going to judge each one of us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
We are all, our lives are all on loan temporarily for us to make a moral decision for or against God.
Mm-hmm.
And if we do not choose him, then we are going to face an eternity much,
mm-hmm.
much worse than the brief
mm-hmm.
time that the Canaanites yeah. were annihilated.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just really, really small thinking that has a problem with this.
Well, I think the modern evangelical response to these objections about the annihilation of some of the Canaanites is twofold. Number one, you don't talk about it. You just don't go into the Old Testament, because this is too much of a conflict for our egocentric Christians, young Christians especially, to deal with.
Yeah.
Because they are so imbued with this idea that God exists to serve us.
Right.
And to even posit an autocratic God who lays down the law for his own long-term objectives without regard to man, without input from man, that's just not acceptable. The other response is to try to water down all this through trying to say, well, it wasn't as bad as all of that, folks. And I did a little reading and I encountered that from popular evangelical sources. They said, well, when he went in and when Joshua went in and he conquered these various tribes and so on, this is just part of the military rhetoric of 1500 BC. It's done by the pharaohs, it's done by the Chaldeans and others and so on. We're not supposed to take it literally. So they're trying to water it down and so on. And as you're saying here, in order to coherently resolve this whole question, you have to start with God and his omnipotent powers to do anything he wants to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the word cannot just isn't in our vocabulary when it comes to God. With God, nothing shall be called impossible, and that takes us all the way back to Christ as the architect of our salvation and all of these wonderful speculations even that we've made about God. When God wants to do something for purposes of love, then he is the law. He can break his own laws. He can do anything he wants to in order to achieve that objective. Yes.
Not only is there no place for cannot in regard to God, but there's also no place for should not.
Mm-hmm.
And for us with our little human minds to pass judgment on God. I'd like to suggest that another way that the modern church, handles this is to say it's different since the cross.
Mm-hmm.
That was the Old Testament. That's the way the God of ancient Hebrews and the Old Testament is.
But look at Jesus. Look at how loving he was. Look how he taught us to forgive our enemies. And they forget Ananias and Sapphira.
Yes.
And how throughout the New Testament we're warned against the penalty of death for sin, which is has now become even more than sacrificing your baby to an idol. It's worshiping an idol in your heart.
Yes.
The New Testament law reflects the same enmity of God against rebellion to his law of love and of loving the Lord first, to the extent that when we harbor bitterness in our hearts, when we cause division in the church, when we lust in order to have our own desires filled, that comes under the sentence of death and separation from God in the New Testament. And so it isn't accurate to say, well, God has somehow changed and he doesn't behave the same way, doesn't have the same value system that he did before the cross.
Yeah.
That isn't true.
Well, of course, Scofield dispensationalism makes it a tenet of God's revelation of himself throughout the ages that he does change in his moral standards, different standards of obedience and so on. And tragically, in modern times, Scofield dispensationalism says that the Jews don't have to obey God in order to go into Palestine, even though they had to do back in the time of the patriarchs. And so the truth of the matter is that God says, I don't change. I don't change. And spiritually speaking, that is an absolute. His standards of intolerance towards sin and rebellion never change. Absolutely never change. And that's part of the apostasy, the great falling away that we're in right now, in which people and so-called Christians are saying that God's standards of obedience do change and have changed. And a soft, easier standard of obedience and dedication is all that's required today than in previous epochs. Yes.
Which is so demeaning to the Bible, because it starts with a huge mass execution in Genesis and it ends in a mass execution in Revelation. I mean, this is
true.
How do we get out of a problem with the Canaanites when we have God himself being the agent of death on a massive scale,
yes,
on the whole planet?
Yeah.
First with water and then with fire. I mean, if your theology can't understand the concept of God being justified in doing that, you really have no business calling yourself a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so how is someone going to say, I'm a Christian, but I'm going to excuse away what the Jews did to the Canaanites, but somehow I'm okay with what God did in Genesis and Revelation? It doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, either we agree with God that this life is really a small value in terms of the quality of what it needs to be for a person. The point of it is about moral decision. That's the whole point of this life. It's not about the quality of your existence here. Or we don't agree with him on that, and then we have a much more fundamental problem than having an issue with the Hebrew issue. I mean, it is just basically the idea of God, what God is telling us is you are going to live forever. I mean, even if we only live for 10,000 years, imagine that your first 80 years are really, really tough, but then you have, what would that be, like 9,900 more that are just paradise and bliss? But it's not even 10,000, it's like forever.
Yes.
So I don't think we should really be begrudging God doing what he wants to do with souls that are going to have an eternity.
Well, of course, this attitude that we are the center of God's attention and his love and indulgence backfires when something really bad happens to us or one of our loved ones.
Yeah.
When we get cancer, when our child is diagnosed with some mortal, lethal disease or whatever, suddenly our quote-unquote Bible or our Christianity has not been proved true in real life. Our God is not the same God we thought he was. That somehow now he's a cruel God, he's an uncaring God. And so it's very, very important that we start our Christian faith, we be taught even from our youth, a realistic and total biblical view of God,
mm-hmm.
with the love on one hand, but the righteous, wrathful indignation and the potential for that. That's the whole meaning of hell. Mm-hmm. And if you water down any part of the Bible, or if you de-emphasize any part of the Bible, you're actually cheating people, you're cheating young people of the necessary armament, the necessary premises. Our premises are kind of a protective shield and an armor around us that help to orient us and keep us from getting thrown and disoriented as some pretty wild curves can be thrown to us in life. And if we do not give complete premises, the armament, the whole armor of God in strong premises rooted in the Old Testament, then the hardships and unpredictable misfortunes of life and even the disasters of life can cause us to be angry at God and to make a foolish and railing charge against God. So I think that I'm increasingly finding that people are baffled by the Old Testament. In order to understand the Old Testament, you have to have a broad overview of what God is all about, what Christian ethics, God's plan of the ages are all about. You have to see the big picture. And I think that more and more we need Bible studies which will specialize in going into the Old Testament. And more and more, in fact, going back to Joseph in Egypt and Jacob and Samson and Abraham sacrificing Isaac, these are all tremendous stumbling blocks for people today. It causes them to be frustrated, baffled. And in fact, I got an email from a man the other day, and he said, I'm just baffled by all of these inscrutable actions of God in the Old Testament. I asked my pastor about it, he said. And pastor, you know what the pastor said? He says, now you know why I never preach from the Old Testament. That's what the pastor told him. Now, how does that help this person? That just says, let's both ignore it. Let's both ignore the Old Testament, and the problem will go away. No. The New Testament, the Old Testament was the schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. Now, every one of us had to learn the math tables, the alphabet, all of that stuff. Again and again and again, we had to go through it so it became a part of our subconscious in our adult life. And that's the important part that is missing in the church today. The Old Testament is kind of the math tables and the alphabet, and modern evangelicals never learned their math tables and alphabet. And therefore, when a math problem, a language problem comes along, they don't know what to do about it because they don't know the principles, the undergirding substratum of what our faith is built upon. Instead, they are fed a lot of nonsense that the substratum of our faith is built upon is the holy Jews. Thank God for the Jews. The Jews who gave us Hanukkah, Purim, Passover, all these wonderful foundational holidays that undergird our faith. Let's go back to the foundational holidays, and that'll give us the background that we're lacking, the lacking in our Christian experience today. So in place of the truth, error is coming in and masquerading as the kind of law and legalism and structure that we need to give some backbone to modern Christian experience.
Yes, I think it's concerning, really concerning, that there are people that follow pastors that have that answer for them. Mm-hmm. That people are asking that question, that a pastor could have that answer for them. I wouldn't consider that to be an acceptable answer, and I would probably have to say, if you don't have some kind of an answer for me or somewhere to direct me, I just can't even fathom following you.